So I want to just say how pleased we are to have Roger Walsh here tonight. It's probably impossible to think of a more appropriate person to be here. And actually, one of the shortest decision-making processes of the entire conference was picking our keynotes. Sean and I had about a 15 minutes worth of exchanges, and it was Roger and Suzanne, and both of them agreed and are here with us this weekend, so we couldn't be more pleased about this. For those of you who may not know, I'm sure you're all familiar, but Roger Walsh is an MD and a PhD. It's quite a bit of schooling, and he's a professor of psychiatry, philosophy, anthropology, as well as an adjunct professor of religious studies at the University of California at Irvine. His research and writings has received over 24 national and international awards and honors, while his teaching has received 1 national and 6 university awards. His publications include The World of Shamanism, Past Beyond Ego, and Essential Spirituality. Roger is, of course, a longtime friend of Ken, was one of the first to, quote unquote, discover Ken's writings. And Roger wanted me to add, I believe he used to be an acrobat and held a world high diving record. And he added the qualifier that these were the most important parts of his biography. So I'll let him explain that. If you'd join me in welcoming Roger Walsh.
Thank you very much. So after all these years of our individual journeys and explorations, here we are together after all these years. I suspect we could have a really very entertaining evening just listening to everyone's story about how you came to be here. Because I know that there are a number of very remarkable stories about how each of us found first the work of Ken Wilber, then the Integral Movement, and began to make our own contributions to it. I think of Sean Hagens, who, as I recall, first discovered the Integral work while he was in the Peace Corps in Africa and was reading Sex, Ecology, Spirituality in a tent by a kerosene lamp and decided as soon as he got back he had to find this guy. For myself, it happened shortly after I finished my psychiatry board exams a lot of years ago. I had done nothing but study for 6 months, and the next morning I climbed on a plane after the exams to go to a conference on voluntary control of altered states. And there was a problem. I arrived at the conference, as I said, I'd done nothing but study for 6 months. I immediately became depressed. So I was in this conference center in the middle of nowhere in Topeka, Kansas, which I'd heard of. And I broke into a hut on the outskirts of the conference, and I hid there for much of the conference, hiding, trying to get my head together. And on the last day of the conference, I finally screwed up my courage and stood up and said something. And at the back of this room, back of the room, this woman stood up and said, "I totally disagree." Well, we got together afterwards to see if we could reconcile our differences, and I guess we succeeded because eventually we got married. Of course, I don't have to tell you sophisticated, spiritual, interpersonal, second-person people that it wasn't quite that simple. But on one of our very early dates, this woman, Frances, arrived with a copy of a very curiously titled book, The Spectrum of Consciousness. And so what did we do? We didn't even make it out the door. We just spent the evening reading this book together. It absolutely ruined what could have been a really hot day. But eventually we tracked down Ken, like many of you have, and we became good friends, and he actually came to live with us for a year. And I can tell you, living with a genius is a wonderful way to exacerbate an inferiority complex. The guy would read 3 books by German philosophers beginning with H in the morning, any one of which would take me a week. There was There was one morning, I remember, he got a book, Life Extension, which some of you may have seen was one of the early health and life extension books. 800 pages. The guy went downstairs, came back up 3 hours later, having read it cover to cover and able to quote drug dosages and chemical formulas. Basically, the experience of living with him was nauseating. I hate people who can read that far. I hate people like him who can write faster than I can read. But there was one good thing Francis and I did for him, and that was we introduced him to Treyer, and just before we went on a trip to Europe, we were away for 2 weeks. By the time we got back, he was engaged. The guy moves fast in a lot of areas. So, and the rest of the story you know from Grace and Grit. So we're here as a result of Ken's vision, of your openness to this vision, and of the work you and so many others have done to create this movement and to create this conference and to bring us together for this remarkable opportunity of being together as a community effectively for the first time. What I'd like to do today is to explore several topics. I'd like to explore first the state of the integral art. Where are we in this integral movement? Second, I'd like to explore the question of how do we optimize the impact of integral ideas? Then, what traps await us? What are our potential shadow and shortcomings? I'd like to look at some of the key ideas that may be important for us to try to get out into the culture. And then address the question which so many of you are working with, and that is, what can we do to help our troubled world? So current status. It's only 13 years since Sexecology Spirituality was published, which was essentially the first formulation of the integral vision. And it's now obviously had a worldwide impact affecting an enormous number of disciplines and topics, and you are the actual representatives and creators of those new integral disciplines. But at the same time, while it is reaching out and touching a variety of disciplines, clearly, integral still remains a minority perspective. In fact, it remains as what the sociologist Peter Berger called the province of a cognitive minority. And he defined that as a cognitive minority as a group of people whose view of the world deviates significantly from the one generally taken for granted in their society. So that's us, deviants. All right. That's something we can be proud of. But it raises an interesting question. Is the integral perspective and vision destined to remain the province of a minority? And it's a really important question, and it may well be, because really to appreciate the integral vision and to contribute to it does demand an awful lot. It demands, ideally at least, at the very least, recognizing, for example, adult stages of development, which is not recognized much in our culture. It requires, ideally, maturing to a post-conventional second-tier level or more, oneself. And it requires an openness to big pictures. And just because one has these cognitive capacities doesn't mean that one is necessarily open to really big pictures. This came home to me a few years ago when I was talking with a colleague at the university, a neuroscientist, who asked what I was doing, and I kind of leapt where angels fear to tread and tried to describe integral and what I was doing. And I, you know, ranted on about, you know, the meaning of life and the universe and how it all fitted together and this and that. And he listened, he said, yeah, you know, I understand. I've become interested in a much bigger picture too. You know, as a neuroscientist, I used to be just interested in the nucleus of the neuron. And now I'm interested in the whole neuron. But how big a cognitive minority will it become? And really that's the question and con and challenge for all of us. Really the challenge that everyone in this room has taken up is to embody this integral vision and to attempt to make a contribution by using it and by sharing it. So that obviously raises the question, how can we be most effective in getting some of the integral ideas, getting the integral vision out there? And clearly, no matter what our discipline, whether we're in psychology or philosophy or conflict resolution or ecology, it will take two things, no matter what the discipline. First, it will take very careful work. And second, it will require becoming a Gnostic intermediary. It will take careful work, whatever our discipline, careful, rigorous thinking and writing, solid, where possible, solid experiments to test theoretical claims, and successful applications of the ideas. But one of the unique characteristics of the integral vision is that because it is developmental, it requires something more. Because it points to and calls to the higher reaches of development, it will require something more for us to be really competent in it. For us to communicate effectively, we will need to become what Carl Jung called Gnostic intermediaries. Gnostic intermediary is a term Jung first used to describe Wilhelm, the translator of the I Ching, because he said that Wilhelm had imbibed the wisdom of the I Ching so deeply into himself that he could communicate it directly out of his own experience. So a Gnostic intermediary then is someone who is able to communicate not just facts, but wisdom and a vision from one culture to another. And that requires three things. It requires, first, the cultivation of that wisdom oneself, the knowing it, the becoming of it, no small task itself. Second, it requires knowing the conceptual system and language of the community you're trying to communicate to. And third, it requires the capacity to link the two so as to create an aha experience. And we as integral practitioners are effectively trying to be Gnostic intermediaries, because we are trying not only to live and share and use a conceptual thought system, but it is really a wisdom-based vision, because it is based in or touches into the higher reaches of development. And there we tap into wisdom and something beyond mere conceptuality. So we are required to become Gnostic intermediaries. Remember the old World War II, you probably don't. Well, not many of you will remember personally the World War II ads, but there was apparently one, Uncle Sam needs you, become a GI. Well, right, become a GI, but become a real GI, become a Gnostic intermediary. So let's look then at some of the potential traps we face, and then some of the key ideas to get out, and then how we might contribute to the healing of our planet. What are some of the traps we face? Well, as you all know well, the integral model has both horizontal and vertical dimensions. And one of my deep concerns is that if integral gets popular, it will get collapsed into a kind of flatland model, because the four quadrants you can get without development, without maturation. The developmental perspective to really get requires one's own development, and that is a whole nother task. So although we could talk about a variety of traps, I want to focus particularly on the developmental ones, because I think those are going to be the ones that really challenge us most. And this will be where we see a significant amount of our integral shadow. Now, each developmental stage and each perspective has its own traps. And of course, integral perspectives are no exception. And there are two kinds of traps that await us, or two kinds of traps in general. There are general and there are specific ones. Though, that is, there are traps which are common across developmental stages. They're not stage specific. And then on the other hand, there are some traps which are stage specific. What are they? Well, the first one is fairly simple and obvious. It's devaluing where we come from. That is, there seems to be developmentally an automatic tendency to devalue and dismiss the stage we're coming from. As we see the shortcomings, the limitations, the limited perspectives that it offers, it is one way in which we can forge a new identity is by reacting against where we were before. And of course, we all know where this is seen most obviously. It's in adolescence. But it can occur at any stage. And for an integral community, probably we see it most clearly in the devaluation of, say, the individualistic stage of ego development, or in the green meme. So what would be skillful attitudes? What would be the optimal attitudes we could adopt to people at different stages? Well, perhaps the optimal attitudes would be care for those people at lower stages, because they're the people we can hopefully help and serve. It would be an attitude of love for those at our own stage, because these are our peers and community and Sangha. And it would be an attitude of gratitude for those at higher stages, because these are our teachers and pioneers. Okay, so first trap, the obvious one, devaluing where we come from. Second trap, the egocentric misuse of one's new stage. As far as I can see, well, I guess I should speak for myself. I don't seem to have been able to avoid this one. And that is, when one sees a new perspective, when one matures in some way, it seems like there's an automatic tendency to use it to aggrandize one's ego. Inflation, grandiosity, specialness, all these things. I am an integralist. This is using integral ideas to reinforce one's ego rather than transcend one's ego. And at spiritual levels, this becomes what's called spiritual materialism, the use of spiritual ideas and insights and capacities in order to foster and support one's current self-concept rather than release it into the next stage. So, first two traps, devaluing where we came from. Second, egocentric misuse of one's new stage. Third trap, overestimating one's newly acquired stage or perspective. This is assuming that one has found the truth instead of a truth. And I find a story that speaks wonderfully to this to be that of Isaac Newton. In 1665, Newton was a student at Cambridge at age 23, and Cambridge was closed down because of an epidemic of plague. So Newton fled to his family farm, and there in a mere 18 months, he revolutionized four distinct disciplines of science. With his discovery of calculus, he revolutionized mathematics. With his discovery of the spectrum of light, he revolutionized optics. He had his initial insights into gravity and therefore changed the face of astronomy. And he had his initial insights into planetary motion. And between those, revolutionized physics and astronomy. So at the end of 18 months, Newton returned to Cambridge, showed his handiwork to his professor, who thereafter did something which has probably never happened in the whole history of academia before or after. He resigned his chair to give it to Newton. It's certainly not going to happen for any student of mine. I don't care if he's Newton or Einstein. Or she. Well, he was then pressed into publishing some of these results, so Newton actually published a paper on optics, to which he received 12 letters of response, at which point he resolved he would never publish again, saying that, quotes, I sacrificed my peace, a matter of real substance. Can you think what email would have done to this guy? How after a lot of pressure, at age 45, he published Principia Mathematica, which, and I quote, is by common consent the greatest scientific book ever written. So here we have a man who revolutionized not one but multiple fields of science, who brought a new coherence to our understanding of the universe and the planetary motion and the forces which keep it in place and keep it in motion. He forever changed our understanding of the universe and provided what was for that time an integral synthesis of absolutely unprecedented scope. Yet at the end of his life, Newton wrote, I do not know how I may appear to the world, but to myself I have been as a little boy playing by the seashore, ever now and then finding a brighter pebble or a prettier shell, while all around me the great ocean of truth lay undiscovered. Likewise, the biographer of Aurobindo, who truly was one of the great integral thinkers of all time, wrote about Aurobindo's vision and the implications of that, and said of the difficulties of communicating this vast integral evolutionary vision of Aurobindo's, this is why it is so difficult to explain the path to one who has not tried, because he will see only his point of view of today, or rather the loss of his point of view. And yet, if we only knew how each loss of one's viewpoint is a progress, and how life changes when one passes from the stage of closed truth to the stage of open truth. A truth like life itself, too great to be trapped by points of view, because it embraces every point of view and sees the utility of each thing at every stage of an infinite development. A truth great enough to deny itself and pass endlessly into a higher truth. Exquisite statement of the integral vision and of the endless passing into higher perspectives. So the third trap then, this tendency to overestimate one's current stage or perspective. Fourth trap, a failure to engage the mainstream. And I have to say, after meeting some of the people here and hearing about some of the work, I'm less concerned about this than I was, but I think it's still a crucial issue for us, because it's talking to fellow integral students and practitioners is fun and easy and delightful, and it's perfectly appropriate and valuable. But The hard work, the real challenge, is in talking to people who don't share this vision, learning to communicate with them, and there, in order that we make sure we don't remain a marginal minority. And because unless we really try to attempt to interface with the mainstream, we will remain a minority. Integral ideas will not be challenged and honed, and neither will we. And integral ideas will not permeate the culture in a way that is so desperately needed. Now, a different subset of traps. Let's call them transpersonal traps. Traps that are specific to second and higher tier. Traps that have traditionally been associated with spiritual traditions. First key trap, and I want to emphasize this is not an all or none affair, and clearly, people here are engaging these issues, but these are a couple of transpersonal traps. It seems to me we need as individuals in a community to continuously remind ourselves of. First one is the trap of settling for merely intellectual understanding. There's such a beauty and power to this integral theory that, and much of the theory can be entertained purely conceptually. But remember the Gnostic intermediary, remember the higher reaches of this model, and the fact that those require direct experience. Because without direct experience of transpersonal states and stages and insights, transpersonal ideas and insights remain what Immanuel Kant called empty concepts. That is, these are concepts which haven't been filled out with experience and therefore lack a richness and meaning and significance that they otherwise would have. And without direct experience, the deeper meaning of these transpersonal concepts, the deeper meaning of the higher reaches of the integral vision, or what philosophers call the higher grades of significance of this vision, will escape us. And here's the kicker, we won't realize they're escaping us. Perhaps the best way of illustrating this is with a story. This comes from E.F. Schumacher. Imagine an animal finding a novel object, and has a very curious smell, and it tastes lousy, and the animal then spits it out. Now imagine a person from a tribal community finding this and thinking, this is a very bizarre thing. This is something which is dark and light and has curious marks on it, and it's great for starting fires. And then imagine a Western child finding it and realizing, oh, it's a book. I can't read it, but it's a book. And then an adult finds it and, oh, yeah, it's a book, but it's a ridiculous book and makes absolutely insane statements and claims. And then imagine a physicist finding it and realizing that this is a brilliant treatise on quantum physics. Now, the interesting thing is that every being or animal or child or person who saw that book was correct in their perception. It did taste lousy, it did have a weird smell, it did have funny squiggles on it. And for an ordinary adult, it makes no sense at all. Now what's really interesting is that each person or animal was correct, and their experience carries no information to them that they are missing the so-called higher grades of significance. Okay. Without some sort of direct experience, learning, maturation, development of the necessary cognitive insights, or openness to the relevant states of consciousness, to the extent we lack those, to that extent too, we will not be what is called adequate to the full grades of significance of the higher reaches of the integral model. As E.F. Schumacher said, when the level of the knower is not adequate to the level or grade of significance of the object of knowledge, the result is not factual error, but something much more serious, an inadequate and impoverished view of reality. And just how important this has been thought to be throughout the centuries can be judged from the words of both the Buddha and Muhammad, both of you who used animal metaphors to describe mere scholars. The Buddha described someone, a scholar who had not practiced, as a herder of another person's cattle. While Muhammad described, quotes, a mere scholar is like an ass carrying a load of books. Now, as a scholar, I think this is a little overblown, but but that's the theory. So practice is key here, and that's a theme that I think is going to keep coming up for us time and time again, is to recognize that this vision requires so much more of us than most conceptual systems, than most visions. Final trap, complacency and stagnation, a failure to keep growing. This is basically the ever-present seduction to settle for one's current stage of development. In general, with obvious exceptions, at each higher state and stage, pains decrease, pleasures increase, powers become more potent, and seductions become sweeter. Sounds good, actually. At any stage, we can cash in our winnings and use our insights and abilities and so forth for our own personal gain and personal material gain. And of course, using abilities is not bad. But problems arise when we use our abilities primarily for ego gratification rather than for service and ego transcendence. This is an ancient trap recognized in many traditions. In Buddhism, it's the description of the god realm, the beings who have accumulated good karma and luxuriate in all sensual pleasures until their good karma is used up, and then it's back down. In yoga, it's the seduction of the cities, the powers. But there's another thing which hasn't been talked about in the spiritual traditions as far as so explicitly, but is very interesting, and that is that the failure to grow creates suffering because the mind seems to have an innate tendency towards growth. One of the most profound and recurrent discoveries across a variety of disciplines, spiritual disciplines, contemporary psychotherapy, and apparently unrelated fields like psychedelic research, is that the mind has an inherent drive towards growth, and that given the appropriate conditions and circumstances, the mind is self-healing, self-actualizing, self-transcending, and self-liberating. This drive has been given many names. Maslow called it the self-actualization drive. Carl Jung described it as the individuation urge. Stan Grof describes it as holotropism, the tropism or movement towards wholeness. Ken Wilber calls it eros. Dzogchen calls it self-liberating. Many different names, all pointing towards a central dynamic of mind, such that if this desire to grow is not met, if it is not, to the extent it is not fulfilled, then we tend to suffer. But at these levels, we tend to suffer in very interesting and usually unrecognized ways, because the kinds of suffering that seem to result from the failure to keep growing at transpersonal stages are more subtle and more difficult to recognize. Maslow called them metapathologies, pathologies beyond the usual neuroses and dilemmas, resulting in symptoms such as existential malaise, or the loss of meaning and purpose, or alienation. Now, the really tricky thing about these metapathologies is that in our culture, they're extremely unlikely to be recognized for what they are. They're just not known of in our culture. They're not all that well mapped in a lot of the spiritual traditions. So that this means that when people fail to meet this inner dynamic towards growth, there will likely be suffering, but of a kind which is not recognized, and as such will not be supported, will not be given the appropriate remedy, the appropriate suggestions, the appropriate understanding. And it's a very interesting question to ask of our culture and probably all affluent cultures. How much of the enormous amount of suffering and pathology in our culture is a function of the failure to understand and fulfill this drive towards development? But there's another side to this. While the mind clearly has a drive towards development, it also has defenses against this. The kind of defenses against transpersonal growth. This became clear to me early on in the game when I went to a lecture by Ram Dass, who was, along with Tim Leary, was famous for being one of only two professors fired from Harvard. Of course, that was for his psychedelic work. But Ram Dass, before his stroke, was a brilliant speaker. And one of the first talks I ever went to of his was one in which he described the chakra system and the states of consciousness and perspectives that arose at each level. And I was pretty new to this game, and I hadn't heard of these before. And as he described the fourth chakra and its perspective and views and how the world looked there, I thought, wow, that's interesting. And as he described the fifth one, I had this experience of, oh, wow. And the moment he'd finished describing it, I couldn't remember a word he said. Then he started describing the sixth chakra. And the next thing I remember is being woken up by the snores of the person sitting next to me. And looking around at this room and finding that a significant number of people had fallen asleep, myself included. It took me quite some time to make sense of that. But as I now understand it, and certainly not because Ram Dass was a boring speaker, he was brilliant. As I now understand it, it was a clue that I had that the way growth worked, the way opening to higher states of consciousness operates is not as I had assumed. I had assumed it was just an opening to entirely novel discoveries. But what this suggested was something very different. It suggested that my falling asleep had actually been a reflection of defenses against the recognition of these higher states. But in order to recognize something, you've got to have some understanding of it and of its implications. So that meant that I had actually, at some level, at least partly understood this higher state and its implications, and that it was a threat to my belief system and current ego state. And this totally turned my understanding of the spiritual path around, because it suggested that spiritual growth is not just pushing into new frontiers, it's actually in part an amnesis, as Plato said, a remembering, a recognition in part, and that we are actively defended against that. Now, of course, I was hardly the first person to recognize this. De Sual spoke of the suppression of the sublime, and Angile spoke of the evasion of growth. Maslow even coined a neologism. He called this the Jonah complex, the fear of our own potential and greatness. And he said, quote, "We fear our best as well as our worst." But Maslow also added a kicker. He said, quote, "If you deliberately plan on being less than you're capable of being, then I warn you that you'll be deeply unhappy for the rest of your life." So overcoming complacency requires two things. It requires not settling for the seductions that come with growth, and it also requires recognizing and overcoming what we might call the terror of transcendence or meta-defenses against growth. And complacency is a doubly seductive trap for anyone who is involved with non-dual teachings, which emphasize always already truth, that we always already are that which we're seeking. And a wonderful antidote comes from Suzuki Roshi, who said, "You're perfect just the way you are, and you could use some improvement." Or as the Christian tradition would have it, God loves you just the way you are, and loves you far too much to let you remain that way. And of course, complacency and stagnation are traps for both individuals and communities of any kind. It's so tempting to kind of congratulate ourselves, and of course that's entirely appropriate, but also part of the gifts we offer each other is the encouragement to keep growing, to remember to remember, as Aurobindo's biographer said, there is always more. So what are the possible antidotes to this stagnation? Well, first, simply being aware that complacency is a recurrent trap for all of us. And second, growth-oriented relationships, individual relationships, groups, and communities. And in my experience, perhaps the most powerful thing one can do to transform a relationship into a powerful catalyst of growth and awakening is to make an explicit agreement that we're going to use this relationship for our mutual learning and awakening. Because if you do that, you give each other permission to call each other when you fall short. And for those of you who would like the advanced course, I personally recommend getting married. This is a wonderful way of honing, pulling away egocentricity. Not entirely, but it's hard to hide stuff from a spouse. Some of you may know Arthur Dyckman, who's a psychiatrist over the other side of the bay. The Dyckman test of enlightenment is the best I've ever heard. Ask the spouse. You just can't get away with you can't hide stuff from your spouse, and you can't take yourself too seriously. As my wife once said, only one of us can afford to take you seriously in this relationship, and it's not going to be me. There's a Chinese saying, if you want to be criticized, marry. If you want to be praised, die. So making use of the whole panoply of relationships, teachers, peers, intimate relationships, and of course maintaining some sort of practice, spiritual practice, integral life practice, I have watched as some very impressive friends and colleagues have fallen into deep traps such as stagnation or depression or alcoholism. And I watched with great interest and quizzed them because I figured if this could happen to them, there was no way I could pretend it couldn't happen to me. And what I found is a common factor in each one of them. Each one of them said, I let my daily practice go. So these are some of the main traps we face. But traps have another side to them. Traps can be stopping points or they can be stepping stones. Depending on whether they remain unrecognized and defended against, or whether we open to them and work with them. If unrecognized, these traps become our integral shadow and cost and take the form of pathology, ineffectiveness, stagnation, and suffering. But if we recognize them, they become opportunities for healing, learning, and growth. And as the Kulanava Tantra says, by what people fall, by that they rise. So our traps are potential opportunities for learning and awakening. And recognizing them and encouraging one another to work with them in possibly quite new and yet to be devised ways informed by the integral vision is one of the great opportunities of our community. Okay. What are the key ideas we can get out into the culture? Let me ask if you would do a moment's exercise. Just take a moment to take a couple of breaths. Each of you is a pioneer in this integral movement. Each of you is devoting a significant amount of your life to this vision and these ideas. What do you think are the most important ideas we and you can get out into the culture? Okay, so each of us will have our own responses to that. Let me suggest some. And these are just mine. They're a sampling of a wide universe of possibilities. First, very obvious. An integral vision is possible. Everyone in this room is basing a large part of their life on this assumption. So I think we can take this as a pretty much a given. This is an idea that's worth getting out into the culture, that an integral vision is possible and invaluable. Second, adult development is possible. This may be obvious to us, but it's sure not obvious to the culture. And yet this idea has the potential to transform the world. I would say, in my estimation, the most important recognition of the last few decades of psychology may be the simple idea that what we have taken to be normality is not the ceiling of human possibility. In fact, what we have taken to be normality is looking more and more like a collective, unnecessary form of developmental arrest. I thank you for that, but actually back in 1968, Maslow pointed this out saying, quotes, what we call normal in psychology is really a psychopathology of the average, so undramatic, and so widely spread, we don't even recognize it. As one wag put it, at last they've found the missing link between apes and civilized humans. It's us! This idea that there are further possibilities, and we'll be hearing from Suzanne tomorrow about this, is just a crucially important idea. and its implications extend into so many arenas, including even into the culture, where as soon as one appreciates this, one can see that so many of our cultural conflicts are actually not, as is usually assumed, just different ideas at work, but are conflicts between different developmental levels, blue states and red states, fundamentalism and contemporary Western culture. Not that development is the only factor, but it's certainly a factor. Third idea. Okay, adult development is possible. But how do we do it? Well, one of the extraordinary pieces of good news is that spiritual disciplines can catalyze development and well-being. We have time-tested technologies available to us for fostering maturation. There's preliminary research on meditation to support this, but much more is needed. And one of the great research questions of the coming years is going to be what aspects of personality and being are developed by spiritual practices and what remain untouched. But the good news is clearly what these disciplines point to is that many of the elements or dimensions or developmental lines of personality that are most important, including the classic virtues such as love and wisdom and altruism, can be fostered and accelerated by spiritual practices. Fourth idea, and I should say that in a recent conversation with Ken, Ken said, this is probably one of the most important ideas we can get out into the culture. The idea that there are actually two very distinct kinds of religion. The first is, I'm too short-sighted, what are you telling me?
I just wanted to say it's FYI 905.
Okay. I will catalyze and speed my own development and do this faster. So, as Ken's point that there are two kinds of religion, there is a conventional narrative religion which centers around, focuses on, depends on belief in a story of some kind. And those who believe are saved, and brothers and sisters, and those who don't believe are heathens and to be saved. And this, of course, is James Fowler's stages of mythic literal and synthetic conventional faith. And tragically, this is really the only kind of religion that our culture recognizes, certainly the media recognizes. But of course, there is also another kind of religion, and that is a psychotechnology, a technology for working with the mind. And the fifth key idea that seems so crucial is that spiritual disciplines are psychotechnologies. Authentic spiritual traditions are designed to train, tame, transform and ultimately transcend the mind, and to develop the highest reaches and goals and values of humankind, the all-encompassing love, transcendental wisdom and purity of heart, which are the great jewels of human existence. And the interesting thing is when you take up a psychotechnology, there's no requirement for belief because you can then test out the religious claims for yourself. So these are two very different kinds of religion, and for the most part in the mainstream, the second is recognized almost not at all. Final idea. To get out, authentic spiritual traditions or disciplines share common goals and practices. This, as Ken has pointed out, is really the first time in human history we've had all the world's religions and spiritual disciplines available to us. And that enables us to do something new. It enables us to do what's called a common factors analysis. Wouldn't it be extraordinary to be able to look across cultures and centuries and ask, what are the greatest sages, the wisest men and women of history, the most mature people, what do they say are the most important qualities of heart and mind to develop? And are there ways of doing so? Well, we can do that now. And what we find as we look across these different traditions is that there seem to be seven qualities of heart and mind that are revered by sages across centuries and cultures as crucial to a full and well-lived life and to awakening to our highest potential. And these practices seem to be the transformation of motivation, ethical living, developing concentration, fostering emotional maturity, refining awareness, cultivating wisdom, and offering service. Let me just briefly mention a couple of these. I'll particularly choose ones which are where the potentials, which are so evident now from these practices, extend far beyond what our contemporary Western psychology recognizes. Let's look at fostering emotional maturity. This actually has two components. One, a reduction of problematic emotions, such as anger, fear, jealousy. And second, a cultivation of positive emotions, love, joy, and compassion. Reduction of negative or problematic emotions. There are techniques, practices for this. Each culture, each spiritual tradition has an array of practices, for example, for working with anger. Reflections, meditations. And the idea being that when we reflect on anger, when we work with it, when we substitute other emotions, we can release it. And we are much better off for it. Interesting, one of the most common reflections is on death. You know, if you're really angry with someone, you wish they were dead, be patient. And it's not to say that these emotions such as anger are only negative. Ram Dass speaks of being with his teacher, Neem Karoli Baba, when Neem Karoli Baba was talking about letting go anger, and Ram Dass said, but can't I even use anger to teach? And Neem Karoli Baba leant up to him, put his nose practically next to Ram Dass's nose and said, no! So reducing negative emotions and cultivating positive emotions, emotions such as love, joy, and compassion. What a different world it would be if it were recognized that love is one of the greatest of human arts. In our Western culture, we tend to think of love so differently. When you're driving home tonight or at the end of the conference, you turn on your radio, you've probably got about a 50% chance of hitting a love song. These are wonderful studies in pathos and pathology. They have lines such as, I can't live without you, I'm constantly thinking about you, I break out in sweats, I can't sleep. These are the symptoms of heroin addiction. Our culture has totally confused love and addiction. Love in our culture is something like an attack of epilepsy that descends on you. You know, if you're with the right person who looks the right way and says the right things, then you can feel love. There is no appreciation that there is actually a technology, a set of practices for the cultivation of this to higher reaches and to an all-embracing extent. Compare the Hollywood version of love with this description by Rumi. Ecstatic love is an ocean, and the Milky Way is a flake of foam floating on that ocean. So love, wisdom. Wisdom is deep understanding. Wisdom, let me just read a beautiful quote from the Torah. Happy are those who find wisdom. She is more precious than jewels, and nothing you desire can compare with her. Her ways are ways of pleasantness, and all her paths are peace. Get wisdom. Get insight. Do not forget. Which raises the question, how do we cultivate wisdom? Well, knowledge comes from the acquisition of facts. Wisdom comes from reflection on experience. Life wisdom comes from reflecting on one's life. Existential wisdom comes from reflecting on the great challenges and mysteries of existence, the mysteries and challenges of sickness, suffering, and death, or of life meaning and purpose, or questions such as, what is a good life? And transcendental wisdom comes from direct seeing into the transcendental source of all. And eventually, of course, we find that it's all a great mystery, beyond thought and understanding. We realize that reality is not only more than we think, but more than we can think. As Lao Tzu said, from wonder into wonder, existence opens. Or as Houston Smith pointed out, we are born into mystery, we live in mystery, and we die in mystery. Best description of that or story of that I know is of a rabbi who used to teach about the impossibility of knowing, the importance of recognizing we just don't know. One morning as he was crossing the village square, he ran into the village policeman who was just had a fight with his wife and was in a lousy mood, and he said, "Hi, Rabbi, where are you going?" Rabbi said, "Don't know." Policeman said, "What do you mean you don't know? Every morning for the last decade you've crossed this square, you've gone to pray in the village tabernacle. What are you telling me you don't know?" So he grabbed the rabbi and hauled him off to the village jail. And just as he was about to throw him in the cell, the rabbi said, "See, you just don't know." And the culminating practice of all is service. Service is both means and end of spiritual practice. And the great secret of service is that, properly understood, it is not self-sacrifice, but enlightened self-interest. As Ramana Maharshi said, all that one gives to others, one gives to oneself. If this truth is understood, who will not give to others? I spent 3 years researching this and writing this book, Essential Spirituality, trying to find these common practices and qualities of heart and mind. You know the biggest surprise in those 3 years of research? That every single one of the great religious traditions said for every one of the seven qualities, if you want to develop this quality, hang out with people who have it. It's the power of relationship and the power of community, and one of the reasons we're together. Consciousness is catchy. So finally, the question, how do we best respond to our global crises? We're clearly in a new phase in human history, and the fate of our planet and our species stands awaiting our choices. You know the problems as well as I do. What's so crucial to recognize is that each and every one of the global crises we're facing is human-caused for the first time in history. And as such, our global crises reflect psychological immaturities and pathologies within us and social and cultural pathologies between us. And the disturbed state of the world reflects the disturbed state of our minds. And what that means is that what we've called our global problems are actually global symptoms. The symptoms of our individual and collective immaturities and pathologies. We're in a race between consciousness and catastrophe. And therefore, we need to address both the state of the world and the state of our minds. We need to feed the hungry and heal the environment and reduce nuclear stockpiles, but we also need to address the psychological and spiritual forces within us and between us, which created these crises in the first place. Yet to date, almost all responses have been military, political, economic. Clearly, we need to address both the internal and external dimensions, left and right-hand quadrants. In short, we need an integral approach. How do we do this? Well, it's interesting that we can put out that question, but actually the question that it always comes down to is, what can I do? And more precisely, what's the most strategic thing I can do? Given my unique situation and life and circumstances and talents, what's the most effective contribution I can make? And this will have different answers for each of us. But as integral practitioners, we'll be trying to do three things simultaneously. We'll be trying to relieve the external social and global problems. We'll be trying to relieve their internal sources, the cultural, psychological, and spiritual roots. And we'll be trying to bring a higher, more integral perspective to bear. In short, we're trying to be perspectival therapists. But our capacity to bring a higher, more integral perspective to bear depends again on our own maturity. And therefore, once again, a crucial requirement is for us to do our own inner work, whether through spiritual tradition or integral life practice or whatever. And how can we do this while serving in the world? Well, fortunately, there is an ancient tradition for just this, traditionally called karma yoga. We might think of it as service learning, and integral life practice is moving towards this also. And there are three key components to karma yoga. One is to offer one's work to the highest good, to Brahman, to God, to the welfare and awakening of all. Second is to work as impeccably as one possibly can. And third, and here's what there's the cutting edge which makes this practice so powerful, is to simultaneously, while working as hard as possible, attempt to let go attachment to the outcome. And in doing karma yoga, we fulfill Aurobindo's suggestion that we transform the whole act of life into an uninterrupted yoga. In doing karma yoga, we go into ourselves to go more effectively out into the world. We go out into the world to go deeper into ourselves. And we keep this going until inner exploration and outer service become one. We live in a time of unprecedented challenges and opportunities. Never before have we had the power to imperil our species and our planet. And never before have we had the power to heal our species and to bring all people to new levels of well-being, prosperity, and maturity. The choices our generation makes will decide whether we leave behind an evolving civilization and a fertile earth, or a failed species and a plundered planet. Part of the power that's available to us is the integral vision. And it's our remarkable privilege to be able to realize this vision for ourselves, to embody and express it in our lives, to use it to understand the world, and to let it use us as willing instruments to help and heal the world. Our world is in grave trouble, but our world also rests in good hands, because actually it rests in yours. Thank you.